Now, Bill, just in case you're not convinced, he asked the question again. If you are as seriously alcoholic as we were, we believe there is no middle-of-the-road solution.
Middle-of-the-road solution. Take your time. Don't rush into taking the steps. Relapse is part of recovery. Just don't drink and go to meetings. If your butt falls off, pick it up and take it to a meeting. Those are middle-of-the-road solutions. Do the work. It's right here. And all your timelines and clear-cut directions for doing that work is in this book. These middle-of-the-road solutions are not outlined in our text. This is what the first 100 did. I don't know what you want. But as I sit here with my feet right where they are in Eugene, Oregon today, I want what they got. And I got to do what they did if I'm going to get it. But the chapter 5 starts out and says, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then and only then are you ready to take certain steps. Uh-huh. I know this is hard language, and I'm not over here trying to shove this up your butt. I'm just telling you about my experience. Because I drink and I die. Uh-huh.
We were in a position where life was becoming impossible.
Yep.
Just the living part. And if I have passed into that region from which there is no return through human aid, I had but two alternatives.
And what's that?
One, I can go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of my intolerable situation as best I can. And the other is to accept spiritual help.
Hmm.
Now, I like the accepting spiritual help. I don't got to figure it out. I don't have to be good enough for it. I don't have to be smart enough for it. I don't have to study for it. I don't have to do anything except accept it. And that is one of the hardest stumbling blocks that men, especially in Alcoholics Anonymous, have. Accepting help. I'm used to earning it. I'm used to manipulating it. You know? It's like the guy passed it on to me, and what was the only caveat? If I take what he gives me, I then have to pass it on. It's got to be a hook.
Accepting,
you know?
Spiritual help. That's a good, simple definition of humility. I can't do this. Would you help me? Yeah, a man approached me on the balcony earlier today, and he said, "You know, I don't deserve to be here." Of course you do.
You wouldn't be here if you weren't.
If you do what we do, you're going to get what we got. I know that sounds so cliche, but if you do what we do, you're going to get what we got. Mm. It's just that simple.
Book suggests that this we did because we honestly wanted to, and we were willing to make the effort. It says a certain American businessman had ability, good sense, and high character.
This is Roland Hazard. He's the guy that we talked about had enough money to burn a wet dog. Let's talk about Roland here for a second. Let's tell you about this guy's substance. Roland Hazard, born into wealth, married in 1910, became active in the Republican Party, served one term as a Rhode Island senator from 14 to 16. He sat on the board of Allied Chemical, Allied Dye, Allied Signal. $18 billion corporation back then. They owned Burlington Industries. His first attempt at recovery was a one-year commitment with Dr. Carl Jung, and we're going to go into that now. But Roland Hazard, once again, he could buy anything on the planet. Hell, he could have bought the boat that he went to Switzerland on. But he didn't have enough money to buy his way out of alcoholism.
There you go. It says, for years, Roland had floundered from one sanitarium to another. Roland consulted the best-known American psychiatrists. Then he went to Europe, placing himself in the care of the celebrated physician, the psychiatrist, Dr. Carl Jung.
All right. Dr. Jung was his third choice. Let's go back to the timeline last night. When Roland started looking, the most prominent name in society of the day was Sigmund Freud. Freud wasn't taking any new patients at any price. His second choice was a guy that was getting elderly by the name of Alfred Adler. Adler was getting too old. He wasn't taking any new patients. Let me tell you the kick here. If Roland had seen either one of those guys, we wouldn't be here because they were both atheists. He gets up hooked up with Jung, and Jung tells him about the spiritual solution. So that was a God shot, man. That was no coincidence. Okay? Yep.
Now, that we would have been somewhere talking about our inner child as we're dying from alcoholism.
And holding teddy bears. We'd be snuggling teddy bears up here today.
You know, it's Keith Lewis, who just passed away about a year or so ago, amazing speaker. He spoke at a place in the late 80s, and it was their headline speaker Saturday night. And he gave his opinion about the medical fraternity and a lot of the quote-unquote psychological measures that were taken to try to help alcoholics. And he says, you know, he suggested that their inner child needed a good spanking, and a lot of those people got up and walked out. And he came back a number of years later, and the first thing he wanted to do was make an amends. He says, listen, I'm really sorry for expressing my opinion in such a way, because those who walked out left their teddy bear sitting in their seats when they left. He wasn't asked back for a while. Says he'd gone to Europe, placing himself in the care of the celebrated physician, the psychiatrist, Dr. Carl Jung, who prescribed for him. He went for a year. Every Thursday for an hour, they met. He was outpatient therapy. Now, it says here, though experience had made Roland skeptical, he finished his treatment with unusual confidence. His physical and mental condition were unusually good, and above all, he believed he had acquired such a profound knowledge of the inner workings of the mind and its hidden springs that relapse was unthinkable.
Self-knowledge.
Nevertheless, Roland was drunk in a short time.
He got drunk on the boat back home.
Says, more baffling still, Roland could give himself no satisfactory explanation for his fall. So he returned to Carl Jung, whom he admired, and he asked him point blank why he could not recover. Roland wished above all things to regain self-control.
Self-control got him where he was, didn't it?
He seemed quite rational and well-balanced with respect to other problems. And we've talked about, we hinted at five different types of alcoholics back in the doctor's opinion. He's type number five. Well-balanced. Normal in every respect, except in the effect alcohol has upon him. And then it goes on to say, yet he had no control whatever over alcohol. Why was this? He says he begged the doctor to tell him the whole truth, and he got it. In Jung's opinion, judgment, I'm sorry, he was utterly hopeless.
You might want to highlight that word or underline it. Hopeless means you're dying, dude. Not kind of, sort of, but you're dying.
Roland could never regain his position in society, and he would have to place himself under lock and key or hire a bodyguard if he expected to live long.
But wait a minute, Doc. I got all this money. What about all this money?
Says this is the great physician's opinion. It goes on to say that, but Roland still lives and is a free man. He does not need a bodyguard, nor is he confined. He can go anywhere on this earth where other free men may go without disaster, provided he remains willing to maintain a certain simple attitude. We're going to skip down to the next paragraph. Roland asks the question straight up, and doctor tells them, you have the mind of a chronic alcoholic. I have never seen one single case recover where that state of mind existed to the extent that it does in you. It says Roland felt as though the gates of hell had closed on him with a clang.
He says, I've seen some guys recover, but Roland, they're not near as bad as you are, dude. Yeah. You're in bad shape. Back here.
What kind of attitude do you believe they're referring to?
Spiritual attitude. That there is a power greater than yourself.
God consciousness.
It's called a complete psychic change. We're about to get to that.
So he asked the question, are there no exceptions? And the best way I've ever seen this put, and it's, I hate to go to a movie like this, but the movie Dumb and Dumber, when Jim Carrey's at the end of the movie and he professes his love to the girl, and she tells him straight up, not in a million years. That little grin that comes across his face when he says, so you're telling me there's a chance. There's a chance. That's an alcoholic chance. So he says, doctor, are there no exceptions? And here are the odds. Yes, there are. Exceptions to cases such as yours have been occurring since early times.
Listen to these odds.
Here and there, once in a while.
Oops.
Alcoholics have what are called vital spiritual experiences. Now, to me, these occurrences are phenomena. They appear to be in the nature of huge emotional displacements and rearrangements.
What we're calling this is a psychic change.
Ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were once the guiding forces of the lives of these men, are suddenly cast to one side. And a new, completely new set of conceptions and motives begins to dominate them.
What we're talking about here, the question in the back was a certain simple attitude. What we are going to be talking about in this book study this weekend, or all we're doing here in AA is trying to change our attitude about three things. Ourselves, when we walked in here, our behaviors and our habits had been so despicable, we in our minds consider ourselves to be pieces of dirt, low self-esteem, if you will. The second attitude is our attitude about our fellows, personal relationships. Did you drop your rocks?
I took Sandy Beach's suggestion.
Drop the rock. Our attitudes about our fellows, because if I ain't feeling good about me, you ain't feeling good about me, and I ain't feeling good about you. Screw you. attitude about God's kids. Third attitude is about God. When I walked in the door, I knew he existed, but he wanted nothing to do with me. I've been a bad guy in my life, and there was no redemption. Attitude about yourself, about your fellows, and God. You with us? Certain simple attitude.
He says, in fact, I have been trying to produce some such emotional rearrangements within you. With many individuals, the alpha methods which I employed are successful, but I've never been successful with an alcoholic of your description. Again, Bill's going to suggest that we go back to amplification in Appendix 2. We're going to wait till he begs. Now, upon hearing this, Roland was somewhat relieved, for he reflected, after all, I'm a good church member. That hope was, however, was destroyed when the doctor told him that while your religious convictions are good, in your case, they do not spell the necessary vital spiritual experience. So here was the terrible dilemma in which our friend Roland found himself when he had this extraordinary experience, which, as we have already told you, made him a free man. We, in our turn, sought the same escape with all the desperation of drowning men.
Go back up into your room or go into one of these bathrooms and fill a sink up with water. Stick your head in it. Hold it there as long as you can. Nature is going to make you snatch your head out and gasp for air. We sought the same desperation as that of a drowning man. Bobbing, please help me. If you ain't got that desperation and you're new in here today, I got bad news for you. This is that window of opportunity. This is one of them.
Now, what seemed at first a flimsy reed has proved to be the loving and powerful hand of God. A new life has been given us, or if you prefer, a design for living that really works.
I'm going to skip over to the next page.
Book suggests, further on, clear-cut directions are given showing how we recovered.
Boy, I tell you what, that's strong language, isn't it? Directions? I hate directions.
Then it says, these are followed by 42 personal experiences. This book was written before the speaker meeting. So here's the speaker meeting in the back of the book. And then the speaker meetings in the back of the book were intended for one reason. It says, each individual and their personal stories describe in their own language and from their own point of view the way they established their relationship with God.
Wow.
The book talked about the central fact of our lives, absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives, that He has done for us what we could never do for ourselves. I'll sit and listen to a speaker in a meeting, and I'm going to express an opinion. I'll sit and listen to a speaker in a meeting, and God shows up about 4 minutes till the very end, and it's in a passing reference, and that's it. My book tells me that I'm supposed to talk about the absolute certainty that my God has entered in my heart. And I'm supposed to describe in my own language and from my own viewpoint how I establish a relationship with this power, with this creator, with this force of the universe. That's my job. Because it's like the wet part of the water. You know, if I'm going to describe the spiritual side of AA, like there's a spiritual side of AA, everything about it's spiritual, you know. But it says this will give others a fair cross section of our membership and a clear cut idea of what has actually happened in our lives. If I'm just not drinking, and I'm telling you that I'm just not drinking, for those alcoholics, and I was one of them who tried the just not drinking thing, they're going to find that story useless. Thank you for telling me about you're not drinking. How do you do that? Is it the meetings you're going to? Because we bury people back in Atlanta who just go to meetings. Is it the service work that you're involved with? Because we find people back in AA who put a bullet in their mouth because all they do is have service. The book talks about a relationship with God, central fact of our lives, absolute certainty. You know, and Larry will harp on certain things. I harp on this one. God. It's all about God. It's all about God. Anytime I think this is not about God, I need to go back and look at it because it's all about God. It's all about God. It's all about God.
Guys, let's take 5 minutes. We got one more chapter before lunch. On this last break, I was approached by some guys, and what's happened through this course of this book study, we've disturbed some people about the question of alcoholism and what they've been doing up to this point in their meetings, and that's a good thing. The meetings are for that new guy that's looking for us, and he's looking for a solution. And hopefully when you leave here, You ain't got to do it my way or Kristen's way or Chris Raymer's way. But tell these guys the truth. Tell them about the solution to alcoholism. You know, me and a guy were talking a minute ago about you get into these meetings and the weed eater comes up and somebody says, well, you think that's something? I got a riding lawnmower. You think that's something? If you think that's something and it's one-upmanship, and the guy's going, you know what? I could go back to the job if I had one and they could tell me the same stuff.
Or I can go to the bar and talk about this.
Yeah, I need a solution because I'm dying here. But he never says anything because we've lost him. And he walks out, he's scared to death and hopeless once again. He's come to the last stop on the block. He's humiliated himself by coming into a lower life form, a group of useless, horrible alcoholics, and they've thrown him away too. We got to quit doing it, guys. This is the lifeblood of our society. Anyway, chapter 3, more about alcoholism. The important thing that you need to know going into this chapter, this is the alcoholic's viewpoint. And you're going to, I don't know about you, you may not. I love this chapter. There's some guys in here that I just love.
Bill goes out on a limb here by suggesting most of us have been unwilling to admit that we were real alcoholics. No person likes to think that they are bodily and mentally different from their fellows. He's talking about page 21, the real alcoholic. Therefore, it's not surprising our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people.
Vain, hopeless,
the useless. Idea that somehow, someday, we will control and enjoy our drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker.
What's that control and enjoy stuff about?
Think about it. When you were having fun with drinking, there was absolutely no control. The wheels were off and just good times. And when I'm having a really good time, I mean, to control it, I mean, here's your stipulation for drinking. You can come if you only have one beer. I'm not coming. I'm sorry, Mom and Dad, but I'm not coming to your anniversary.
No. Control and enjoy. There's two deals going on here.
Yeah.
If you're controlling, you're not enjoying. If you're enjoying, you're not controlling. You can't get them two things going at the same time.
Yeah. And then it goes on to say the persistence... that says the drinking is the greatest... All right. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many of us pursue it into the gates of insanity or death.
All right. There, huh? I'm going to define three words in one... We're going to kill three birds with one stone.
Come on, Harold.
Obsession, illusion, and delusion are insanity. Sanity, the definition, is wholeness of mind. What do you reckon insanity is?
Got a
so obsession, illusion, and delusion are all the same thing. Simple insanity. People say that power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Hell, I'm not crazy. I go, really?
Let's take a look at your life for a second.
Let's talk about this for a second.
Book suggests we learn that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholic. This is the first step in recovery.
There you go.
The delusion that we are like other people, or presently, maybe, has to be smashed.
Doesn't say it needs to be talked about or discussed. It needs to be smashed because you ain't like nobody else.
Yeah. This is such a key thing because there's this understanding that happens on a gut soul level that does. It's not an intellectual concept. Understanding alcoholism in my head was easy. Understanding it on a fundamental level in my gut and in my soul was not. Understanding the step one, that I cannot drink because I'm powerless over alcohol, my life has become unmanageable. When I read step one the first time, it said, you cannot drink. That's what I read. When I conceded to my innermost self, step one took on a whole new meaning. Step one took on a meaning now when I conceded in my gut that I'm going to drink. Step one does not mean that I can't drink. Step one is that I'm going to drink, no matter how badly the necessity or wish, no matter how much I don't want to, I will drink again. That's the great abnormal thing about alcoholism. The idea that somehow, someday, I will control and enjoy my drinking. I don't have the mental capacity to not think about the consequences. And even if I do think about them, The book suggests that they are readily supplanted with this threadbare idea that this time it'll be different. I'll handle myself like a gentleman. I'm a grown man and I deserve a drink. It goes on to sit there and say the delusion that we're like other people or presently maybe has to be smashed. Delusion and denial are two words that treatment centers love to throw around. And denial is thrown out real subtle. He's in denial about his alcoholism.
This next line gives one of many descriptions of the alcoholic. We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. That's the allergy section of the disease.
Yeah. Now, the difference between denial and delusion is very subtle. Denial is when you know the truth and it doesn't apply to me. I knew what alcoholism was and I understood it, but it wasn't my deal. Delusion is you don't even know the truth. And Dr. Bob was in the delusion. Bill Wilson was the first person who came and told him the truth about alcoholism from an alcoholic's viewpoint. He talked about all the subtle insanity that precedes the first drink. Delusion is a big deal because a lot of people don't understand why they're in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we haven't qualified them. How many people qualify alcoholics who walk in and raise their hand and say for the first time, I'm new, this is my first meeting? Do we qualify them? Because most of them have no clue what alcoholism is. They think their problem's alcohol. They don't understand alcoholism. And that's a key thing because the people who die from alcoholism may not understand that that's what put them in the grave.
Goes on to say that we know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control. Ever is in italics. Remember we talked about the extra money it cost to change the typeface.
All of us felt at times we were regaining control, but such intervals, usually brief, were inevitably followed by still less control, which led in time to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization.
You all understand the pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization? Mm-hmm. You know what that means? Remember those days where you did that thing in front of the family or your boss, or you came to in the middle of the street? You remember those? Yeah, see all the nodding? Mm-hmm. Welcome. Cool.
We are convinced to a man that alcoholics of our type are in the grip of a progressive illness.
Now, what they're talking about is the progression of alcoholism. We followed it through Bill Wilson's life. He discovered alcohol, and then all of a sudden, it ceased to be a luxury. And that's the way it was. We ended up here on the hill today because we're in the grip of a progressive disease. Mm-hmm. Just like cancer, unless you give it some chemo and nip it in the bud, you know what I'm saying? Because it never gets better.
Over any considerable period, we get worse, never better.
There we go.
Bottom of page 31. You see these pamphlets, our well-intentioned fellowship, right? 20 questions. The book has two places where they suggest two tests. One is a set of questions. One is a series of actions. Here's the action. Bottom of the page. We do not like to pronounce any individual as alcoholic.
You guys got a new guy. He's vibrating. He comes up and he says, you know what? I'm not sure I'm alcoholic. I don't know if I belong here. You guys just look like a bunch of old duds to me. All you do is drink coffee and smoke cigarettes. I say, well, Mr. New Guy, here's what we suggest you do.
Can I call you new? But you can quickly diagnose yourself. Alcoholism is the only disease that does not manifest itself in my life as a real, like the way Scott Redmond talks it, as a real piece of business until I diagnose myself. I was dying of alcoholism for years before I recognized I had alcoholism. It was there, but it wasn't real for me until I acknowledged I had it. And I used to run the comparison. I used to date this girl who was a lifeguard. And she would throw the life preserver into the pool for the kid in the end of the pool who was drowning. But until the kid acknowledged that he was drowning, he didn't grab a hold of the life preserver. There's nothing that could be done. She ended up diving in to grab him and pull him out. Until I acknowledge my alcoholism, it doesn't exist. It's not real. I'm not dying from it. So we have to diagnose ourselves.
And what do you do?
We step over to the nearest bar room and try some controlled drinking. Try to drink and stop abruptly.
And then try it again.
You've got to do it more than once. It says it will not take long for you to decide if you are honest with yourself about it.
Honest, there's your caveat.
It may be worth a bad case of jitters if you get a full knowledge of your condition.
All right.
We're going to talk about a couple of different examples. Bill Wilson, in the book, they give four specific examples of different types of alcoholics. Included the stories in the back of the book and Bill's story, there's a number of different examples. I didn't hear it the first story I heard. I didn't hear me in the first story I heard. I heard it when I went into this chapter.
We're going to go over to page 35, first, second full paragraph, our first example. And I'm going to tell you something.
Well, actually, this will be the second example because we're skipping one. So,
this guy, Jim, y'all going to love Jim.
Yeah.
Y'all going to wish you'd have known Jim. Jim's real name was Ralph Furlong. Mm-hmm. He was in the first edition. His story was called The Prodigal Son.
Yeah.
And Jim is a hoot. I just love this guy.
Yeah. It says that our first example is one we're going to call Jim. As a man, his charming wife and family, he inherited a lucrative automobile agency.
His old man passed away and left him a Chevrolet store.
Jim had a commendable World War record.
Great. He had so much garland on his and salad on his chest. He'd done well in the Army.
Jim's a good salesman.
Sell anything.
Everybody likes Jim.
Everybody loved him.
Jim's an intelligent man, so normal so far as we can see, except for a nervous disposition.
Oops.
Now, Jim did no drink until he was 35. In a few years, Jim became so violent when intoxicated, he had to be committed.
Jim loved to drink liquor and fight.
Come on.
He'd drink a glass of scotch and kick your ass. And every time he did it, they had to lock him up.
On leaving the asylum, Jim came into contact with us.
So he's at the treatment center, and he leaves, and he calls A&A.
We told Jim what we knew of alcoholism.
We told him about the first step, that he was powerless over alcohol, that his life had become unmanageable.
And the answer we had found.
We told him about step two.
Yeah. Jim made a beginning.
Oops.
Jim's family was reassembled. He began to work as a salesman for the very business he lost through drinking.
I'll be damned. So he lost that Chevrolet store because he couldn't stay sober.
All went well for a time.
Mm-hmm.
But Jim failed to enlarge his spiritual life.
Yep.
To his consternation, Jim found himself drunk half a dozen times in rapid succession.
And you know what Jim does when he drinks. He fights. Mm-hmm. So to this consternation, that's amazement or horror. To his horror, he found himself drunk a half a dozen times. Because what did he do? He took step one. He took step two, but he didn't make that vital decision in step three.
Yeah. To his consternation, he found himself drunk half a dozen times. On each of these occasions, we worked with him, reviewing carefully what had happened.
I asked him, what'd you do, Jim?
I only had one. Jim agreed he was a real alcoholic and in a serious condition.
So he agreed once again to step one, best proposal.
Jim knew he faced another trip to the asylum if he kept on.
So he knew if he drank anymore, he's going back to the treatment center.
And moreover, he'd lose his family, for whom he had a deep affection.
He didn't want to lose his family again. He done lost them one time.
Yet Jim got drunk again.
I'll be damned.
We asked him to tell us exactly how it happened. This is Jim's story. I came to work on Tuesday morning.
I wonder where Jim was on Monday.
I remember I felt irritated. I have to be a salesman for a concern I once owned.
He used to own this place, and he's selling used cars now. He ain't even in a new car department. Mm-hmm. And he says, I had a few words with the boss. Boss probably said, Jim, where were you yesterday? Mm-hmm. Nothing serious. Now, I want you to, this paragraph that we're reading, if you have a pen, you might want to bracket this paragraph. This is normal, sane thinking. He's having a few words with the boss.
Nothing serious.
Nothing serious. Normal, sane thinking.
Then I decided to drive into the country. I'm going to see a prospect for a car.
Normal, sane thinking for a car salesman. He's been out here before. He might find a prospect and sell a Chevrolet.
On the way, I felt hungry, and I stopped at a roadside place where they have a bar.
Normal, sane thinking for a hungry car salesman.
I had no intention of drinking.
Not a bit.
Just thought I'd get a sandwich. You know, I also had the notion I might find a customer for a car at this place. It's familiar. I'd been going to it for years.
Normal, sane thinking so far.
I had eaten there many times during the months I was sober.
They had great bologna sandwiches at this place.
I sat down at a table, ordered a sandwich and a glass of milk.
Normal, sane thinking so
far. Still no thought of drinking.
Mm-mm.
I ordered another sandwich, and I decided to have another glass of milk.
This is normal, sane thinking for a real hungry car salesman. But if you'll notice, there's some squiggly writing coming up here. And what happened to him?
Suddenly the thought crossed my mind that if I were to put an ounce of whiskey in my milk, it couldn't hurt me on a full stomach.
That's what I'm thinking. Abnormal, insane thinking.
I ordered a whiskey, and I poured it into the milk.
Well, of course he did.
I vaguely sensed I was not being any too smart.
But
I felt reassured as I'm taking the whiskey on a full stomach.
Abnormal, insane thinking.
Now, the experiment went so well, I ordered another whiskey and I poured it into more milk.
Well, of course he did, because see, that first one set up what? the allergy of the body. He didn't have a choice.
Yeah. It didn't seem to bother me, so I tried another.
Well, of course he did.
He didn't have a choice before the first drink. He was simply following the call of nature after he had one.
Thus started one more trip to the treatment center.
Now, here was the threat of commitment, loss of family and position, to say nothing of that intense mental and physical suffering which drinking always caused him.
And here's some squiggly writing.
Jim had much knowledge about himself as an alcoholic.
He was fully convinced that he was powerless over alcohol, that his life had become unmanageable.
Yet, all reasons for not drinking were easily pushed aside in favor of the foolish idea that he could take whiskey if he only mixed it with milk.
It's called the obsession of the mind.
Whatever the precise definition of the word may be, we call this plain insanity.
There we go.
Now, how can such a lack of proportion to the ability to think straight be called anything else? We're going to skip over to the top of page 39.
Let's take another illustration.
We skipped it, and I apologize because we talked about test question one on the allergy, but you can go back to top of page 34 and make a bracket on that paragraph because it's test question two, which is on the obsession of the mind. We skipped over that. Apologize for that.
39, I'm sorry.
Second paragraph starts out by saying, Fred, he's a partner in a well-known accounting firm.
Fred is another guy. He was an early member of AA. His real name was Harry B. And Fred's he's a white-collar guy, blue blood. He's a partner in an accounting firm.
Fred's income good. He's got a fine home, happily married, and the father of promising children of college age. And Fred has so attractive a personality, he makes friends with everyone.
Yeah, once you meet Fred, you just love him. Fred's a good guy. Yeah.
If ever there was a successful businessman, it's Fred. To all appearance, he's a stable, well-balanced individual, yet Fred's alcoholic.
Oops.
We first saw Fred about a year ago in a hospital where he'd gone to recover from a bad case of jitters.
So AA shows up and he's in the treatment center snaking and shaking. He calls it the jitters. It was his first experience of this kind and he was much ashamed of it. Far from admitting he was alcoholic, he told himself he came to the hospital to rest his nerves.
Yeah, I'm in 4-point restraints for shits and giggles.
But I got this one. I'm good.
The doctor intimated strongly that Fred might be worse than he realized. For a few days, he was depressed about his condition. Fred made up his mind to quit drinking altogether.
Go, Fred.
Yeah. Now, it never occurred to Fred that perhaps he could not do so. In spite of his character and standing, Fred would not believe himself an alcoholic, much less accept a spiritual remedy.
In the South where we're from, they call this guy Much Man. Very proud. Very proud. He could whip any problem. He's a strong moral fiber, and that's what this guy is.
Mm-hmm. We told him what we knew about alcoholism.
We told him about the first step.
Fred was interested. Is this Fred or Jim? Yeah, Fred was interested, and he conceded he had some of the symptoms.
But
I'm a long way from admitting that I could do nothing about it myself. He was positive that his humiliating experience plus the knowledge he had acquired would keep him sober the rest of his life. Self-knowledge would fix it.
He wouldn't even look at the second step. Yeah,
why would he? I ain't got that problem. We didn't hear from Fred for a while. One day we were told he was back in the hospital, quite shaky.
He's back in the treatment center all shaking and snaking.
He soon indicated he was anxious to see us.
Call them fellas from AA.
Damn it. The story he told is most instructive, for here was a guy absolutely convinced he had to stop drinking, who had no excuse for drinking, who exhibited splendid judgment and determination in all of his other concerns, yet flat on his back, nevertheless. We're going to let him tell you about it. You know, I was much impressed with what you fellas said about alcoholism, and I frankly did not believe it would be possible for me to drink again. I rather appreciated your ideas about the subtle insanity which precedes the first drink, but I was confident it couldn't happen to me after what I had learned. I reasoned I was not so far advanced as most of you fellows that I had been usually successful in licking my other personal problems and that I would therefore be successful where you men failed. I felt that I have a right to be self-confident. It was only a matter of exercising my willpower and keeping on guard.
Every time he exercised his willpower, he ended up in the jitter joint.
Mm-hmm. I like the way Fred's talking about it. Basically, what he's saying is, thanks for sharing. I got this. In this frame of mind, I went about my business, and for a time, all was well. I had no trouble refusing drinks, and I began to wonder if I had not been making too hard work of a simple matter. One day, I went to Washington to present some accounting evidence to a government bureau.
He's probably going up to Washington to see the IRS.
I'd been out of town before during this particular dry spell, so there was nothing new about that.
You might want to underline the words dry spell. This guy's a fire hazard. He's wanting to drink so bad.
Basically, I felt fine. Neither did I have any pressing problems or worries. My business came off well. I was pleased, and I knew my partners would be too. It was the end of a perfect day, not a cloud on the horizon.
Fred is so proud of himself. His chest is all puffed out. He's made that call back to home, back to the home office and said, "Fellas, I've made us a bunch of money today."
Fred is under the delusion that he knows what his relapse is going to look like. And that is a scary place because everybody in this room has at one point in time envisioned what a relapse will look like. Like I'm going to be able to see it coming. Like it's going to kick open the front door and take hostages. My experience is that's not how relapses occur. Relapses don't usually kick open the front door and take hostages. They usually slide around the back door, start sliding in a piece of furniture here and a lamp there. Next thing I know, it's moved in and I need a drink. I didn't even see it coming. And you know, he hits that old saying that a relapse starts months before the first drink. You know, I stopped going to meetings just enough. I stopped praying just enough. I stopped calling my sponsor just enough. I stopped 12-step work just enough. All of a sudden, that subtle insanity comes back and I drink. But it doesn't like that.
And so once again, Fred's about to tell himself a lie.
I went to the hotel and I leisurely dressed for dinner.
Here's some squiggly writing.
As I crossed the threshold of the dining room, the thought came to mind. It would be nice to have a couple of cocktails with dinner.
That was all.
Nothing more. I ordered a cocktail and my meal.
The operative word is he ordered a cocktail.
Yeah.
Then
I ordered another cocktail.
Of course you did.
After dinner, I decided to take a walk. I
wonder where Fred went.
He went
for a little walk.
Went to the ATM.
Okay.
gotta get some money. When I returned to the hotel, it struck me an 8-ball would be fine before going to bed. So I stepped into the bar and I had one. Fred's full of, he's lying.
He's so full of it.
I remember having several more that night and plenty the next morning.
So when he went to the bar and he got that highball.
Come on.
He got a handle jug to go back up to the room with. He said he had plenty that night and several that night and plenty more the next morning because he didn't sleep. He was in love with that handle jug.
He says, I have a shadowy recollection of being on a plane bound for New York. Finding a friendly taxi cab driver at the landing field instead of my wife.
My brother was a very flamboyant gay man. He was in the fellowship. He 12-stepped me. But the thing was, when his name was Talmadge, and when he would drink, he'd pick up the phone and call people at 3 o'clock in the morning, family members, and tell them about their incestuous behavior and shit. So when Talmadge would come out of a blackout, he had a path of destruction and people on fire wanting to kill him all across the country. So what happened, here's what I imagine with Fred. Fred's all drunk. He's sucking on a handle jug back in his room. He's lit up. He calls her up. He says, let me tell you something, bitch. You about your mama and your sorry sisters. So he says he has a shadowy recollection of being on this plane, and there's a friendly cab driver waiting on him at the airstrip. Because she's done said, I ain't picking him up. So he gets in his cab, and what happens?
The driver escorted me about for several days.
You ever rode in a cab? What would it cost from, say, for a 15-mile cab ride? $30? $40? Fred's in a cab for days. You think he probably found an alcoholic cab driver. He's buying this guy a toot every now and then, you know?
He says, I know little of where I went or what I said and did.
Mm-hmm.
Then came that hospital with unbearable mental and physical suffering.
So he's back in the treatment center.
He says, as soon as I regained my ability to think, I went carefully over that evening in Washington. Not only had I been off guard, I'd made no fight whatever against the first drink. This time, I had not thought of the consequences at all.
He could not, with sufficient force, bring in the horror and the humiliation
of yesterday,
or the day before, or last week.
I had commenced to drink as carelessly as though the cocktails were ginger ale. I now remembered what my alcoholic friends had told me. They had prophesied that if I had an alcoholic mind, the time and place would come. I would drink again. They had said that even though I did raise a defense, it would one day give way before some trivial reason for having a drink.
Why is that? Because, see, Fred conceded to the step one, but he never took step two. He never came to believe that a power greater than himself could restore him to sanity. Mm-hmm. One is as far as he got.
He says, well, just that did happen and more. What I learned of alcoholism did not occur to me at all.
Step one.
I knew from that moment that I had an alcoholic mind. That's one of the reasons why we keep going back to that test questions one and two. Listen, if you're not convinced on being alcoholic, my job is to not convince you. Alcohol is going to be the great persuader.
Talk
alcohol will
Raymer.
Beat you into it. You know, Chris, I love Chris Raymer. He got a call. He leads an alumni group, and one of the family members of an alumni who come through the treatment center he works with called him up and said, would you come and talk to my 15-year-old son? So he came over with his big book, sat down. She went to go make lemonade and cookies. He looked over at the son and says, do you want to quit? The son said, no. He closed his big book, got up, was starting to leave. She walks out. Where are you going? Well, he don't want to stop. Why am I going to? I'm not going to say anything that's going to persuade them to stop. Alcohol is a great persuader. And if I'm working with a guy who's here because of a DUI, if they don't believe they're alcoholic, I can either beat them over the head with this big book, which is pointless, or I can be there for them when they come back, because if they're truly alcoholic, they're going to drink again, and I can be there for with them for a solution that they can walk in, and they're going to know that I didn't try to enforce this upon them, that I got a real solution for a real problem. And if you can't identify with alcoholism, that's fine, because it didn't exist until I diagnosed myself. So, he says, I've never been able, he says, I saw that willpower and self-knowledge would not help in those strange mental blank spots.
Obsession of the mind.
What I know about alcoholism will not keep me sober. I had never been able to understand people who said that a problem had them hopelessly defeated. This is the kind of guy who could always pull himself up by the bootstraps, who could always find another way to make it happen, who had another plan. And he goes, I knew then. It was a crushing blow. He had never before been cornered. Now he was cornered. There's no other options. He goes, two members of AA came to see me.
They grinned. I didn't like that so much, and they asked me if I thought myself an alcoholic, if I was myself alcoholic, and if I really was licked this time. He didn't like it when these guys come in laughing at him.
Yeah.
He says, I had to concede to both propositions. Step one, powerlessness and unmanageability. And then they piled on him heaps of evidence to the effect that an alcoholic mentality such as I exhibited in Washington was a hopeless condition. They told him about their drinking episodes, their thoughts that preceded the first drink, and what happened to them after they drank. Talked about their experience.
Mm. Oh, sorry, I thought you were going. This process snuffed out the last flicker of conviction that I could do the job myself. They didn't come in and said, are you done for today? They came in and asked him, are you done? Are you through? Are you done trying to manage alcohol? Are you willing to try something different? And until that decision was reached, little hope could be held.
The book doesn't say that you will stay sober a day at a time. You know how that goes around the fellowship?
It says we live one day at a time.
We live one day at a time. We have quit drinking for good and all.
It says this process snuffed out that last flicker of conviction that I could do the job myself. You're going to need power that you don't possess, and we got something for your ass.
And then they did what?
They outlined a spiritual answer.
Step two.
And a program of action, which 100 of them had followed successfully.
Steps 3 through 9.
Now, I like how Fred writes this. Though I had been only a nominal churchman, their proposals were not intellectually hard to swallow.
But
this program of action, though entirely sensible, was pretty drastic.
Whoa.
It meant I would have to throw several lifelong conceptions out the window.
Old ideas.
I like the way Scott Lee puts it. Some of what I know for sure ain't. I've bet my life on some of this information, which I am now finding out was wrong. Whew. Like, men don't cry. Men don't share emotion with one another. You never let them see you sweat. Man, those are all lifelong conceptions that had to be thrown out the window. It says, that wasn't easy, but the moment I made up my mind to go through with the process.
Step three.
I had the curious feeling my alcoholic condition was relieved, as in fact it proved to be. Then he's going to say something that we've heard somewhere else in the book. It says, quite as important was the discovery that spiritual principles would solve
all
my problems.
Not some or most. All my problems.
He says, I have since been brought into a way of living infinitely more satisfying and, I hope, more useful than the life I lived before. My old manner of life was by no means a bad one, but I would not exchange its best moments for the worst I have now. I would not go back to it even if I could. In the bottom of the page says, once more, the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink, except in a few rare cases. Neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power.
Guys, we're going to finish this session. You're going to go grab some lunch. We're coming back at 1 o'clock, and we are going to get into what? We agnostics. Enjoy your lunch. Thank you for your participation this morning. Chapter 4, agnostics. I sometimes call it we antagonists. You know, you got a wet guy, and he's shaking, he's vibrating, and he's got questions about alcoholism. You got a couple of choices. You can pull out that pamphlet that says 20 questions to test yourself whether or not you're alcoholic. But I invite you to just kind of, in your mind's eye, imagine Bill Wilson walking into the gatehouse of the Cyberling Mansion. Dr. Bob is vibrating. He's sick. Wilson walks in with this brochure. And he says, Dr. Bob, could I ask you 20 questions?
Get the hell out of my house.
Get the hell on. Take it down the road. So what Christian's about to do, he's going to give you the two questions. And these are all you need. And then if they're not convinced, invite them to go to page 31 and step over to the nearest bar. Mm. Don't go with them.
Yeah, they'll get you sick quicker than you'll get them well. In the preceding chapters, you've learned something of alcoholism. He only beat our head into it about 50,000 different times.
By the way, the closing shot, we have been on nothing but the first step until right now. Everybody good with that? We're easing into step two.
We hope we have made clear the distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic.
And here's your two questions.
If when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, you're probably alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
If that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer.
I invite you to underline the word only. This isn't one of many. It's the only thing we've found since we read about Proverbs earlier that Solomon wrote.
Now, to one who feels they're an atheist or an agnostic, such an experience seems impossible. But to continue as we are means disaster, especially if we're an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. To be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis, they are not always easy alternatives to face.
Let me give you a visual on that. You got a guy and distended liver, he's all jaundiced, and you say, look, dude, if you don't stop, you're going to die an alcoholic death. Now, I have a solution, and it's spiritual in nature. What's your choice to be? He goes, how bad is an alcoholic death? I mean, that's the alcoholic. Yeah, I'll give you a buzz tomorrow. Is your number still? So we're going to skip forward to the next page.
There's a speaker by the name, I can't remember who told the story, but the story goes something like this. The new guy's got less than 6 months. He's walking with a sponsor, and they're going to go meet another guy who lives on the street, literally on the street, cardboard house, everything. And as they're sitting there talking to him, the suggestion is thrown out that, you know what, if you keep drinking, you're going to lose all this. Really? If I'm lucky. Top of 45, first paragraph says, lack of power. That was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves. Obviously. We used to think that was the shortest sentence in the whole book. In working with others, nonsense is the shortest sentence. But obviously, but where and how are we going to find this power?
Well, he's going to tell us once again what this book's all about.
Well, that's exactly what this book's all about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem.
Sounds like a promise, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
All right, we're going to skip forward.
46. We're going to skip. We're in that first, with the top of the page.
We look.
And three lines down starts out, the first full sentence says, "We looked upon this world of warring individuals, warring theological systems, inexplicable calamity with deep skepticism. We looked askance at many individuals who claim to be godly." You know, there's guys out there named Jim Jones, Jimmy Swaggart, you know, Jim Baker, a lot of Jims.
The Jim Squad.
And they're all from the South. "I have sinned." You know, I mean, we looked, they claim to be godly. How could a supreme being have anything to do with it all? And who could comprehend a supreme being anyhow? Yet another moment we found ourselves in thinking, when enchanted by a starlit night, well, who then made all this? There was a feeling of awe and wonder, but it was fleeting and soon lost. Bill Wilson's taken us a trip down his memory lane, his experience with trying to define and comprehend that power which is God, trying to wrap his head around infinity, and it can't be done. And he's going to exercise his experience along most of our experiences. Some people walk in here and have no problem with God. Not my story. I know it wasn't his, you know. The book says, "Yes, we of agnostic temperament have had these thoughts and experiences. Let us make haste to reassure you, we found that as soon as we were able to lay aside prejudice and express even a willingness to believe in a power greater than ourselves, we commenced to get results, even though it's impossible for any of us to fully define or comprehend that power, which is God."
Let me tell you what the definition we found of agnostic. Because there's somebody in here that doesn't know what that means. Agnostic is one who professes ignorance or denies that we have any knowledge, save a phenomena, one who supports agnosticism, neither affirming nor denying the existence of a personal deity, a future life. You know, ag is without. Nos is knowledge. Without God.
Much to our relief, we discovered we did not need to consider another's conception of God. Our own conception, however inadequate, is sufficient to make the approach and to effect the contact with them. As soon as we admitted the possible existence of a creative intelligence, a spirit of the universe underlying the totality of things, we began to be possessed of a new sense of power and direction, provided we took other simple steps. This is... I always kind of come back to this. I'm working with a new guy. He's kind of new to me. And I've taken him to this because he was indoctrinated with doctrine, theology, religion, over and over and over again as he was growing up. And I always come back to this, and I said, you know, the book says this: we found that God does not make too hard terms with those who seek him. To us, the realm of spirit is broad, roomy, all-inclusive, never exclusive or forbidding to those who earnestly seek. It is open, we believe, to all men. Because, see, 99% of the world's religions do this. They set criteria, belief systems, doctrines and theology, and you have to fit through a narrow set of criteria. Believe as we believe, and you can have what we have. But AA does exactly the opposite. They spread the option, and they create all-inclusive. I don't care if you believe in a light bulb or a tree. As long as you're willing to believe that it has more power over you than you, you're well on your way.
I sponsored a Greek priest one time, and here I am, Southern Baptist. I want to go back to the previous things that we've covered so far. This first step, it's an observation that we're powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Observation, conclusion of the mind. Observation, conclusion of the mind. You haven't, that's not a working step. And this step here, it says, came to believe. Coming to believe is a strong suspicion that maybe, just maybe. You with us? It's a strong suspicion. It doesn't say I came to have faith in. There's a progression here for this alcoholic. And the progression is like this. I'm beaten into a state of submission. And I wandered into the rooms in September of 87, hoping so desperately that there was something there that would save my life. I hung around you for a minute. Welcome back, Kirk. You look so much better.
I'll tell you my snap, thank you.
Well, it shows. You were so damn ugly a while ago. Anyway, I came in and I had hope that maybe, just maybe, there was something here. You had a magical panacea for me. And what I did is I watched you. I watched you really close. And you showed me what you did. And I believed that you believed. Hope, belief. And then after I did it for a while and I saw the change or the help progress, and all of a sudden I had life again, I had faith. I had faith that this would work for me in all conditions. If I did what you showed me that you did, hope, belief, faith. Step two is nothing more than a strong suspicion. Okay? A lot of people think we're jumping off the deep end here, that you're about to profess something. You're not professing a damn thing. All we're asking you, do you believe that we believe? Are you willing to believe? That's it. Strong suspicion. Go ahead.
Top of 47 says, when therefore we speak to you of God, we mean your own conception of God. And this applies to other spiritual expressions which you find in this book. This is Bill's experience right here. Do not let any prejudice that you may have against spiritual terms deter you from honestly asking yourself what they mean to you. At the start, this is all we needed to commence a spiritual growth, to affect our first conscious relation with God as we understood. Afterwards, we find ourselves accepting many things, which then seemed entirely out of reach. That was growth. But if we wished to grow, we had to begin somewhere. So we used our own conception, however limited it was.
Doesn't matter how minute it is. And here's step two.
We needed to ask ourselves but one short question. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there is a power greater than myself? As soon as a man can say that he does believe or is willing to believe, we emphatically assure him he's on his way.
I don't know what that was. There's your arch chart again. Believe, willing to believe, built on a foundation of complete willingness. Do you believe, or are you willing to believe? Do you have a strong suspicion that there may be, just maybe, something out there that's more powerful than you?
So again, it's going to say, please be sure to read Appendix 2 on the spiritual experience.
Let's do that. Let's flip over to the back of the book, Spiritual Experience. I'm on page 569 in the third edition.
567 in the fourth.
Something I want to bring to your attention. Bill Wilson hated using the same word twice. So he would use different words that meant the same thing. In here, he's going to talk about change 12 times. Using 7 different words. They all mean the same thing. Forget about it.
Back here, can't see. All right. Five 567 starts out by saying the term spiritual experience, quote unquote, and spiritual awakening are used many times in this book, which upon careful reading shows that the personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism has manifested itself among us in many different forms.
Spiritual experience is what Bill had. Sudden and profound, white light, hot flash kind of a deal, burning bush. Spiritual awakening is, we're going to talk about it here, comes more gradually.
Yeah. Best way, I love the way we share things. We share things in a way that makes sense to us at the time that we share it, and then sometimes we don't hear it. You can hear the same speaker tape for 1,000 times, and on listen 1,001, you finally hear what the speaker was trying to convey because you're at a point now where you can hear it. I didn't understand the difference between awakening and experience. And somebody suggested for my consideration that I look at awakening experience a lot like I did losing my virginity, which is an experience, and being in a healthy sexual relationship, which is an awakening. Or suggesting that experience is a one-time event, whereas an awakening takes place over a gradual period of time. I am more awake at 1:15 than I was at 6:45 this morning. And at 7+ years of sobriety, I'm more awakened spiritually than I was at 1 year of sobriety. He's more awakened at 21 years than I am at 7. You know, and awakened people aren't thirsty. When you're awakened to the presence of God, you're not thirsty. So we're going to, you know, just different ways of looking at the same thing. It says, yet it's true that at our first printing gave many readers the impression that these personality changes or religious experiences must be in the nature of sudden spectacular upheavals.
Upheavals is change.
Happily for everyone, this conclusion is erroneous. In the first few chapters, a number of sudden revolutionary changes are described.
Revolutionary is change.
Though it was not our intention to create such an impression, many alcoholics have nevertheless concluded that in order to recover, they must acquire an immediate and overwhelming God consciousness, followed by at once by a vast change in feeling and outlook. Well, among our rapidly growing membership of thousands of alcoholics, such transformations,
change,
though frequent, are by no means the rule. Most of our experiences are what the psychologist William James calls the educational variety, because they develop slowly over a period of time. Quite often, friends of the newcomer are aware of the difference
change
long before he is himself. They finally realize that they have undergone a profound alteration
change
in their reaction to life, that such a change could hardly have been brought about by themselves alone. What often takes place in a few months could seldom have been accomplished by years of self-discipline. With few exceptions, our members find they have tapped an unsuspected inner resource, which they presently identify with their own conception of a power greater than themselves. Most of us think this awareness of a power greater than ourselves is the essence of spiritual experience. Our more religious members call it God consciousness. Most emphatically, we wish to say that any alcoholic capable of honestly facing his problems in the light of our experience can recover, provided they do not close their mind to all spiritual concepts. We can only be defeated by an attitude of intolerance or belligerent denial.
I'll hook up with that.
We find that no one need have difficulty with the spirituality of the program. Willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness are the essentials of recovery, but these are indispensable.
Around our area, there are clubs called the How Club, the How Place. H-O-W, honest, willing, honest, open-minded, and willing. And they did that, the fellowship, because it's convenient. Meet Me at the How Club is a great speaker tonight. Mm-hmm. But that's not the way it goes. The book says that it's willingness. That's how you get here. You're honest, and then you're open-minded to the concepts of those that have gone before us. So it's who instead of how. Seems like a matter of semantics.
There's you'll see them hanging up at different AA meetings or clubhouses. You'll see the 12 steps, then you'll see the 12 traditions, then you'll see the 12 principles. These are, you know, step one is honesty, step two is open-minded, step three is willing. Like, these were the principles that Bill Wilson had in mind when he was writing these steps, and that's not what happened. These steps weren't written with specific principles in mind. He was approached before speaking back in the late 50s, and they were asking him about the principles behind the steps. And he literally put a bunch of principles down: honesty, open-mindedness, willingness. You know, he got courage, faith, integrity, you know, perseverance, brotherly love, service, you know, dependence upon God. You know, these are some of the principles that were... But they were put down just in a way that made sense at the time. Our steps, the spiritual principle behind step one, isn't necessarily just honesty. How about willingness? How about courage to admit that these are some powerful things. And somebody will come back, and it may seem like semantics, but somebody will say, and I'll hear it all the time, well, I'm not there yet, so I don't have to practice integrity. Okay, so we're going to go back. They go on to say there's a principle, which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep us in everlasting ignorance, and that principle's contempt prior to investigation. How do you know you won't like it if you haven't even tried it?
All right, so we're going to flip over to 48, faced with alcoholic destruction. It's kind of the middle of the first paragraph.
Seven lines down, right in the middle of that paragraph, says, faced with alcoholic destruction, we soon become as open-minded on spiritual matters as we had tried to be on other questions. In this respect, alcohol was a great persuader. Alcohol finally beat us into a state of reasonableness. Now, sometimes this was a tedious process. We hope no one else will be prejudiced for as long as some of us were.
At the bottom of the page, everybody.
The best example I've ever seen of that is when the guy I was talking to when I was out living on the streets wanted some particular piece of information. I didn't have an answer for him. I don't know what the hell you're talking about. When he pulled out a gun, my attitude towards his question changed, which is, what did you want to know again? The gun was a great persuader. Just like we mentioned earlier, if I'm coming in here and I'm not convinced, my sponsor's not going to convince me. She's not going to convince me. The judge won't convince me. We call that frothy emotional appeal. Alcohol's the great persuader. It will beat us.
I got to want this. And this is so elemental. I got to want this worse than I want that. I know what that out there is. It's like a gorilla. And you know, guy talked about making love to a gorilla. You get done when the gorilla's done.
Yeah.
I mean, the gorilla's out there right now going, you know, you give up, when he's got all he wants and you're free to go. Yeah. Alcohol ain't done with me. I just ain't walking back in the cage no more.
Yeah. We got to give credit to Adam Todd for that because that's one of the best examples over here. The bottom of the page, last paragraph.
Last full paragraph.
Says everybody nowadays believes in scores of assumptions from which there is good evidence but no perfect visual proof. Doesn't science demonstrate that visual proof is the weakest proof?
I got to tell you, this proof of phenomena. When I walk up on this river and I hear stories about this river, Father Tom up here telling me I'm drinking water that was filtering down through charcoal when the Civil War was going, I can't get my brain around that. A year ago, maybe, but 100 years ago, get out. I can't get my brain around that, guys. Didn't he say that it melted in a glacier, filtered down, and I'm drinking the water from 100 years ago?
Yeah.
Can you get your brain around that?
Yeah.
I don't believe you. Anyway. Yes! I got to tell you, guys, that's some strong... I don't know. I got a pea brain. Maybe I'm slow. But it says, and does not science demonstrate that visual proof is the weakest proof? Let me talk to you about that. Back in the day before computers, men of science and mathematicians used a slide rule. And what they did back in the day is they took a bumblebee and they put that sucker on the slide rule. And here's what they came up with. The bumblebee can't fly because its body is too bulbous and its wings are too stubby. The only problem with that theory is nobody told the bumblebee. So he just flies around and does whatever he wants to do. Scientific proof. You with us here? Because we're about to ask you to venture into an area that there's no proof of, unless you look around at me and Christian.
Hopefully we're not the only examples you're looking at.
Well, we're a couple of, we're both dumpster divers, man.
Mm. All right, Bill Wilson, we're going to skip ahead to the bottom of page 49. And Bill Wilson spends a couple of paragraphs in the next couple of pages going over examples of how us as intellectual beings got it all figured out and how we will outthink and outwit ourselves, and we might be too smart to get it. You know, my first sponsor knew I was way too smart and I was going to miss this thing because I was going to try to figure it out. And the way my first sponsor said it, doesn't need your figuring, need your doing. And that's what it's all about. It doesn't need my interpretation like his first sponsor said. It needs our doing. Get down and just do it.
His sponsor told him, Bill said, Doc, the way I interpret this, that's enough right there, college boy. He says, this stuff don't need your interpreting. It needs your doing.
I always like the idea of sitting down on a bench, and I look over at the weights on the bar. Understanding how the weight bench works is great, but I'm not going to get big muscles from watching the weights go up and down, and I'm not going to get big muscles by watching or knowing how it works. I'm going to get it by lifting. I'm going to get it by doing. I'm going to get it by repetition. That's how I'm going to get the results. And so me understanding it is great, but it does nothing to change my alcoholism. So, and that's where he's at. In the bottom of page 49 says, we who have traveled this dubious path beg you to lay aside prejudice, even against organized religion. We have learned that whatever the human frailties of these various faiths may be, those faiths have given purpose and direction to millions. People of faith have a logical idea of what life's all about. Actually, we used to have no reasonable conception whatever. We used to amuse ourselves by cynically dissecting spiritual beliefs and practices when we might have observed that many spiritually minded persons of all races, colors, and creeds were demonstrating a degree of stability, happiness, and usefulness, which we should have sought ourselves.
Y'all remember on them Sunday mornings, if you were lucky enough to have a car, you're coming home after a weekend run or a week-long run or a month-long run, and you're driving down that street in Oregon or wherever you're from, and you pass by that church with the steeple, and that square station wagon's parked out front, and them square little kids jump out, and that square-looking woman, and that guy with that square tie and that square haircut, they're all getting out, and you're riding by going, how can they live like that? You're all red-eyed and probably got puke down the front of your shirt. But we judged them. We took their inventory. We did that character assassination. And it says that they were demonstrating a degree of stability, happiness, and usefulness that we should have sought for ourselves. I'm guilty. I mean, I've been, ever since I was a kid, taking that Sunday school money and going and buying cigarettes with it.
Yeah. Top of 50 says, instead, we looked at the human defects of these people, and we sometimes used their shortcomings as a basis of wholesale condemnation. We talked of intolerance while we were intolerant ourselves. We missed the reality and the beauty of the forest because we were diverted by the ugliness of some of its trees. We never gave the spiritual side of life a fair hearing.
Yep.
Skip down two paragraphs. Says, here are thousands of men and women.
Early fellowship.
Worldly indeed. They flatly declare that since they have come to believe in a power greater than themselves, to take a certain attitude towards that power, and to do certain simple things.
Steps 4 through 12.
There has been a revolutionary change in their way of living and thinking. In the face of collapse and despair, in the face of the total failure of their human resources, they found that a new power, peace, happiness, and sense of direction flowed into them.
Wow.
This happened soon after they wholeheartedly met a few simple requirements. Once confused and baffled by the seeming futility of existence, they show the underlying reasons why they were making heavy going of life. Leaving aside the drink question, they tell why living was so unsatisfactory.
Leaving aside the drink question. Christian touched on it either in this morning session or last night. Take alcohol out of the equation. I had an old-timer walk up to me one time. He says, what's the matter with you, boy? I said, I got a drinking problem. He says, no, hell you don't. He says, you got a thinking problem. And it took me a long time to figure that out. It's not my thinking. It's not my drinking that got me here. It was my thinking. Because my thinking was flawed, so therefore I poured stuff in there to change the way that I thought and felt. You hook up with that? So, leaving aside the drink question, the first 100 tell why living was so unsatisfactory.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
What does the book say? It says we are restless, irritable, and discontented. That's without a drink. I'm not getting over a craving for alcohol. You can be separated from alcohol for years. Restless, irritable, and discontented. You know, fire hazard.
And then it says that they don't tell us. They show
how the change came over them. Now, when many hundreds of people are able to say that the consciousness of the presence of God, wow, awareness of the presence of God is today the most important fact of their lives, they present a powerful reason why one should have faith.